was the 1970s, and the Jesus movement was gathering steam. So was the addiction to all kinds of new drugs. Charles Ringma was trying to save kids from the worst of it, and save their souls, too. Hi, I'm Rachel Kahn, and today's Spirit of Things on RN is about a man who's been one of this country's most passionate Christian activists. And yet, for all his work establishing organizations like Teen Challenge and the Good News Center in Brisbane, his own Christian outlook has changed and become more inclusive.
I am very concerned about tribalism. I'm very concerned about thinking in little boxes. And I believe that what needs to happen is we constantly need to be pulled out of our comfort zones into a wider and richer tradition. That's why I also believe we need to be open to other religious traditions as well.
The journey of faith is a never-ending one for Charles Ringma. And yet this specialist in mission and evangelism hasn't been unfocused or unsure about his Christian belief. It's just that he knows it rests on a much larger tradition than is usually acknowledged in the Protestant Church. A prolific writer, a former professor of mission at Regent College in Vancouver, a researcher in social work and social policy at the University of Queensland, Charles Ringma has been a Christian activist for much of his life. Now in a more reflective mood, and with a new publication, a major opus called Hear the Ancient Wisdom, Charles spoke to me in his home in Brisbane, and I think you'll find he shatters some of the stereotypes of what it means to be a true believer. Well, Charles Ringma, thank you so much for allowing me into your home. It's absolutely beautiful here, surrounded by green and birds, so I imagine we will be interrupted a few times.
Happy interruption, I think.
Indeed, and perhaps even by that little pooch over there,
yes.
Banjo, beautiful name.
Yes.
Suitably Australian.
He's sweet, and we love having this little monkey around.
Well, Charles, looking at your CV, I'm overwhelmed at how active you have been. This has not been a Christian faith that has just been nurtured in the academy, but very much on the streets and engaged with people. Did you come from an unusually active Christian home yourself?
The home that I came from in Northern Holland was a home which was activist in the sense of small business people. So both of my grandparents were businessmen, some of my uncles as well. And of course we were brought up in the Dutch Reformed Church, and the good old Protestant work ethic was very much a part of our daily lives. And so this is the whole sort of Calvinist streak. And I'm quite sure that I must have drunk that in with my mother's milk.
Well, that Dutch Reform theological view of the world where people are thoroughly fallen and destroyed and lost without belief in Christ, assisted by God's grace, can be a pretty severe sentence.
Absolutely. So that was the kind of background that I grew up in. And when I got to be about 14 or so, that began to be a huge crisis for me. That severe notion of God, a tendency to, you know, read the Bible in fairly dark terms in terms of, you know, judgment and so forth and so on. So that crisis then led to coming to a different kind of faith, one of love of God, one of grace, one of generosity, and so on.
Was that something that you were able to develop early, or did it take a long time?
Well, you know, very clearly, you know, when you mentioned, Rachel, about this activist background, I would say that both the way that I was brought up and also the way that I functioned as a person was that I tended to be serious, fairly hardworking, very activist, instead of doing one thing, I'd be doing two or three things at the same time, having a job during the day and studying at night. And I think that this more kind of compulsive personality that I was had something to do with also the way that I saw God and the way that I understood life more in more general terms. And so, yes, it's been a very long journey because coming to a different view of faith involved also becoming a very different kind of person, because I believe that faith and the way that you are and the way that you live your life have to come together in some integrated kind of way. So it's been a very, very long journey for me to deal with the compulsive activist side of who I think I still am. And that was the reason why I was attracted to the monastic tradition and to the contemplative tradition and so forth.
Well, one of the things you did as a young man at the age of 20 was to take yourself off to Western Australia and work with Indigenous people, Aboriginal people who at that time were not even considered full citizens of Australia. Yes. Yes. You were there, I guess, in a missionary capacity. Yes. What did that experience teach you?
Well, the first, and I think this was a huge experience for me, was that I've come, of course, from a middle-class background in Holland and then growing up in Australia in terms of middle-class values. And then to see what was happening to our Indigenous people. At that stage, this was in the 60s, a lot of the people in inland WA were living on the edge of small towns near the rubbish dump. There were very high infant mortality rate, a lot of problems, really a broken community. And so the first thing that I realised was how much middle-class values had shaped my life, had departmentalised life almost, in terms of us and them. And as time went on, I almost underwent some sort of fundamental conversion, a kind of a recognition that we can see the world from the position of privilege, but we can also see the world from a very different perspective, from the poor, people who are marginalised, people who are struggling, and also then to see the goodness that's in those communities, then to recognise my own arrogance, my own sense of I'm here just to help instead of to learn. Yeah, it was a major shift for me. It, I think, fundamentally marked the rest of my life.
Well, then you would continue on to work with people who were struggling with yes. addiction, and you established yes. in Brisbane here the Good News Centre. Mm-hmm. How did you see your faith in those early days? Was it a sort of cure-all for all the social ills?
Well, I was young. So when you're young, you tend to be a bit messianic, foolishly so. You also tend to be optimistic. You think, you know, a lot of things are possible. But I think that one of the things that I began to learn was that persons who were in situations of great vulnerability, whether that be addiction or whatever, they had to make their own journey towards well-being rather than a program that I might have established or becoming part of some rehabilitation program. So I think fairly early in the piece, though I was optimistic in terms of all sorts of possibilities, I began to realise that just like I have to make my own faith journey at my own pace and my own journey in terms of coming to terms with the unwellness that was in me as a person, in a similar way, it was all about providing people with space and time for them to make their own journey. So rather than fixing people, which is what I first thought, this is much more about accompanying people, being alongside of them as a kind of a support structure so that they could make their own journey towards wholeness and well-being.
And that wholeness and well-being, though, was a faith in Christ, living a Christian life?
I very early in the piece began to understand wholeness and well-being in much broader terms. Yes, I mean, one could have any sort of faith in God, in Christ, or whatever. But what about psychological well-being? What about social well-being? What about relational well-being? And of course, I wasn't working on my own. I was working with a team of people. And the members of the team were people with different skills. So I'd done theological training. Others had done social work training, psychological training, and so forth. We began to realize that wholeness, while it needed some sort of faith or spiritual center, was something that had to be expressed in all areas of life. So what's the point, for example, of somebody coming to faith but not being able to find a good job? It was that kind of sense. But all of this was something that grew on us, because the programs that we set up, they didn't come out of a professional modality. They came out of a bunch of young people who wanted to do something with regard to seeking to serve the poor in our city.
Well, in the 1970s, which is when we're talking about sociology and social work were, I guess, at their heyday, and there were lots of models that were being talked about and used and taught. But social dysfunction was generally seen through a Marxist analysis, which was the result of economic deprivation. How did that very prevalent view fit with a Christian perspective on causes and solutions to the problem of addiction?
It became very apparent to us in that the first thing that we did was not to provide programs for people in the illegal drug scene, but to be exposed to them and become involved with them. So one of our initial moves was to get alongside of people and befriend people in the drug scene. So therefore, what happened was that over a period of time, we began to hear their stories, their background, how and why they became involved with heroin or whatever. And what became very apparent was that people basically came from situations of brokenness, broken families, backgrounds of abuse, etc., etc. And while I think a Marxist analysis is always appropriate in that there are always meta factors, bigger factors that are at play in terms of what happens to families and to social institutions, I think you also need to complement that with an existentialist analysis. So what about people's lived experience relationally and in family structures and so forth and so on? It then became fairly clear to us is that it was out of this settings of dysfunctionality that people then turned to drugs basically as a way of dealing with the pain that they couldn't deal with in other ways. So our approach then was very much not in terms of a kind of a structuralist approach, but much more an existentialist approach.
Charles Ringmer was Professor of Missions and Evangelism at Regent College in Vancouver, Canada, a post that he held until he became Professor Emeritus in 2005. Originally from Holland, he calls Brisbane home, which is where I caught up with him. You're with the Spirit of Things on RN. Well, around this time, I think you established Teen Challenge, and I wonder whether you were aware, had you seen it in operation in America, where it originated, founded by the Assemblies of God pastor David Wilkerson.
Well, actually, what happened was that in terms of the work at the Good News Centre, that's where the drug problem first began in those days, began to emerge on the streets of Brisbane where we were working. I was then sent with support from Lifeline Brisbane to go to various programs in Europe and in England and in the United States of America to look at various treatment modalities. So I looked at hospital-based programs, psychiatric-based programs, community-based programs, and so on, and also the Teen Challenge program. So I was overseas for about 6 months, and at the end of the day, given my own faith journey, my own experience with Australian Aborigines, my own experience in terms of working on the streets of Brisbane, that I felt that the most appropriate kind of program that had to be contextualised here was a teen challenge kind of program. What happened was that in working with Don Wilkerson, the brother of David Wilkerson, in New York, he very strongly pointed out to me, you've got to make this an Australian reality, not a New York reality. So the whole thing then of trying to rethink through what that kind of a program could look like here was a huge challenge.
Well, appropriately called Teen Challenge. It was a Charles Ringmer challenge. Well, I remember Teen Challenge in Canada in the 1980s. It was often regarded as a cult because of its intensive indoctrination processes, its use of slave labor almost. People had to clean and work very hard. They were isolated from family members and friends. Was that the model you employed? I think we've got a lot of competition out there.
You want to try that again? That question again?
What do you think?
I'm happy to answer it. No, we did not use that kind of model. What we decided to do here in Australia was to develop a community-based model as opposed to an institutional-based model. And what was at play there then was the theological training of some of the persons who were part of our team. And what we began to look at was the monastic tradition. We began to look at other forms of intentional Christian community, including the Moravians, and then the whole small group movement that came out of the Wesleyan renewal movement, and then looked at other models of contemporary forms of intentional Christian community. So as a result, the way that we set up Teen Challenge here in Brisbane was that it was family-based and communally oriented. So Rita and I, with our four children and a number of other staff, are living in a large family home. We would take in four or five people from the street who were on a journey towards wholeness. So the setting was family.
Wow, pretty challenging for your family.
It was challenging, and also it was also enriching, because it was very significant for persons who came from broken families and families of abuse. Instead of them ending up on the psychiatrist's couch or in an institutional model of care, they came back to a family model. So the place of their former wounding then became a place for the possibility of renewal and recovery. So the basic model in terms of the way in which we developed the whole Teen Challenge organisation was around small intentional communities like that.
And Charles, did it work?
Well, it depends on, of course, how you evaluate success. Was it a good experience for people to be in a family setting? The answer was, for many, yes. Did people, after time with us, whether that be 3 months, whether that be 6 months, whether that be longer, were some of them able to live meaningful lives, etc., etc.? The answer was yes. Were some of them able to overcome addiction problems? The answer was yes. But very clearly, there were others who we know even today who are still struggling with addiction issues, all sorts of problems. So our orientation wasn't in terms of numbers and success. See, all of those are institutional indicators. But if you function as guests and then friends of an extended family, which is there to provide a setting of safety and respect, I can remember we had people who were just completely freaked off their brain through drug use in Karanda and so on. I would spend hours teaching a person how to sweep the footpath, for example. So it was helping people just to come back to very normal skills. learning how to cook again, etc., etc. It was that kind of a setting.
So the simple tasks of kind of home economics, as it were,
yes,
almost,
really. Yes.
Of how to survive. Well, you were a student of sociology yourself and a research assistant in the Department of Social Work and Social Policy at the University of Queensland. How did that experience, that professional sociological training, inform your model of rehabilitation? But also, more importantly, how did it affect your Christian teaching?
I always think that the time that I was at the university, being involved as a researcher, was a time of great privilege, in that it was wonderful to be with key persons who, within that kind of a professional setting, were willing to outwork certain values that they held. It's very interesting that none of my colleagues that I worked with ever became a full professor. And one of the reasons why they did not was because they chose to focus on research which was oriented towards the marginal, the poor, and the needy. So it's obvious, Rachel, that if you want to, enhance an academic career, you don't get funding to work with people with disability. There's not mega bucks in that, and there's not a mega career in that kind of work. So one of the reasons why I was there was because that allowed me to continue similar values that I'd already learnt in terms of working with Australian Aborigines and working with street people. I was able to transfer those sorts of values also in an academic setting.
I want to ask you about that. How receptive was the sociological community to a Christian, an active Christian? Because sociology is generally seen as the secular kind of religion, almost a secular church.
True, but one of the interesting things about the Department of Social Work and Social Policy was that we had the whole spectrum. So we had neo-Marxist, basically influenced by the Frankfurt School. We had humanist existentialists, and then we had feminists. And then we had some staff who had a more Christian orientation. But the beauty of the late 70s and the late 80s was that relativism had become so strong in academic settings that it allowed for a whole spectrum of views, philosophical views. So just as much as I was happy to work alongside of people with a neo-Marxist perspective, and I myself have been strongly influenced by neo-Marxist thinking myself in terms of my sociological training. So Jürgen Habermas is a great thinker who's influenced me greatly. So in other words, in that kind of mix of faculty with different perspectives, that really opened up the possibility of a very rich environment for students in which to study. And it opened up, I think, also a very rich environment in terms of certain kinds of research being done in that kind of a setting.
You also founded the Jubilee Fellowship. Now, is that a member of the International Collection of Jubilee Churches?
No, actually, I never regard myself as having founded it, but basically what happened was that in terms of the work with street people, people with drug addiction and so forth and so on, there were persons who came to be with us who had a particular denominational background. Some are from a Catholic background, some Protestant, and some from no background at all, of course. And what we explored with young people was, the possibility of, would you like to go back to your own tradition? Some were happy about doing that, and others said, no, we don't. We would like something that's different.
The Reverend Charles Ringmer speaking to me in Brisbane about the Jubilee Fellowship he established. And we'll find out just how different and demanding it was in a moment. You're tuned to The Spirit of Things on RN, on air and online, where you can download this program on your mobile or just listen to it on your laptop. Before we hear about the Jubilee Fellowship, here's one of Charles's favorite songs from Leonard Cohen's Old Ideas album, Come Healing.
Oh, gather up the brokenness, bring it to me now. The fragrance of those promises you never dared to vow. The splinters that you carry, the cross you left behind. Come healing of the body, come healing of the mind, and let the heavens hear it, the penitential hymn. Come healing of the spirit, come healing of the limb.
Behold the gates of mercy in arbitrary space, and none of us deserving the cruelty or the grace. O solitude of longing, where love has been confined, calm healing of the body, come healing of the mind. O see the darkness yield.
So Jubilee Fellowship sort of came into being as a kind of an alternative way of being church with a kind of a very different kind of format. It was interdenominational, it was more community-based. We did a lot of drama and dance and music and sat in a circle instead of in, you know, pews looking at each other's, at the back of each other's neck. You could bring your dog, to, you know what I'm saying? It was weird. It was pretty weird.
Well, Charles,
but they felt at home there. That was the thing.
Well, Charles, that sounds a lot like the emergent church.
I've
spoken to a number of people on that subject, on the Spirit of Things, the Australian Michael Frost, the American Brian McLaren.
Yes.
This post-denominational, creative, more open-ended way of doing church, does that remain attractive to you?
It does and it doesn't, in that it really depends, I think, on where a person is in his or her own life cycle and life development. I think if you're younger and you're a bit more you know, wacky and what have you, you know, kind of emergent church is really, really wonderful. Kind of anything goes, you know what I'm saying? But I think in terms of midlife and on, I think what happens is that you begin to look more for structures. I think you look a little bit more for tradition, maybe more for liturgy. So I think it depends on what age you are.
Well, just about that. I mean, you have been through several ages now. And I want to ask you about your interest in Thomas Merton, the American Trappist monk who died early in 1968, but has remained quite an influence on Christian thinking.
Yes.
What was his influence on you?
Well, I had a particular important turning point in the when I was in my mid-30s, still in the 1970s, I had a massive breakdown. So this activist, compulsive, hardworking, you know, lot of needy people, etc., etc., I sort of got caught in all of that and had a very major physical breakdown. That lasted for about 6 months, and what happened then was that I went into a sort of a period of what St. John of the Cross calls the dark night of the soul. And of course, the more you try to get out of it, the more you become locked into it. So, and of course, I didn't know what to do. So it was out of that experience that I then began to realize that I was a problem in terms of my compulsiveness, etc., etc. And so I then began to a journey with regard to searching for other sources of inspiration. And that's been quite a long journey. But the reason why I was attracted to Thomas Merton was that he was not simply a Trappist monk, but he was also a very radical social thinker in terms of social transformation. And of course, I was more at that end of things. And so I thought, well, maybe from Thomas's writings, I can gain more what the contemplative dimension to life is all about. So that's almost been a journey for me now for the last 20 years in terms of trying to integrate the contemplative and the activist, not only in terms of my thinking, but also in terms of who I am as a person.
Well, who you are as a person has taken you more recently to the Northumbria community. Mm-hmm. Now, again, that is a post-denominational, I think one could call it, mm-hmm. kind of Christian community in Scotland, mm-hmm. that has a daily office and daily reflections on the community rule. And I have to say that I looked at its website the other day, and its reflection for the day was this: don't look for the kingdom on the mountains, for it's coming in the streets. Mm-hmm. And I thought, Charles Ringmer, that's where you have always been.
Yes, well, the reason for my interest in Northumbria community actually comes from the very thing that we were just talking about in terms of Thomas Merton. And also, to some extent, goes back to the way in which we developed these household communities, looking at the earlier monasticism and the Moravians and so on. And I think that the reason why Northumbria became attractive was because it is basically a dispersed community. Now, we have, for a long, long time, we have lived together in different forms of intentional Christian community, like cluster living and extended households and so on. And to some extent, that's a wonderful way to live, but also very, very difficult. So I then began to think about, well, are there other ways of doing community? And one of the forms that's encouraged by Northumbria is dispersed community. So what holds people together is not the fact that they happen to live in the same house or happen to live next door, but a liturgical rhythm of prayer following the Celtic Daily Prayer Book, and for people then to come together informally from time to time if people live within reasonable distance of one another. So that was sort of one dimension. But the other really important dimension, I think, is that Celtic spirituality, which is one of the hallmarks of the Northumbria community, is something that's incredibly attractive today for a whole range of reasons. That kind of Christianity was deeply rooted in family, in an ordinary way of life. It had a tremendous sense of love of nature, in seeing God in nature. It was also a spirituality that was profoundly missional, because it was the Celts who evangelized barbaric Europe from the 600s through to the 1100s. They also formed various monasteries and so forth and so on. So there's a very, very kind of interesting mix there that I found attractive. And so what's happened over the last year, a group of us have been meeting, thinking about Celtic Christianity, and we have recently formed Northumbria Community Brisbane as a way of encouraging others to begin to live that more liturgical and prayerful form of life as laypersons, not as clergy.
Well, that sort of self-directed, innovative, exploratory kind of approach to the Christian life puts at the forefront, I suppose, a willingness to change and to be open to change. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking of the sorts of people that you have been drawn to write about, because you are a prolific writer. You have focused your attention on Dietrich Bonhoeffer. We've already talked about Thomas Merton, the biblical scholar and theologian Rudolf Bultmann, and, of course, the anarchist Christian Jacques Ellul. These were all people who you could could say, had a certain irreverence towards tradition. And you could say they also had something of an audacious spirit. Has that also characterized you?
Well, I'm not so sure. Maybe I'm a bit of a wannabe, but I've always believed in a kind of a balance between what is institutional on the one hand and what is non-institutional or more organic or more familial or more relational on the other. So, for example, when I've been teaching in various institutions, one of the things that I've always tried to do in getting alongside of my students was to find out what their real interests were. And so, yes, by all means, you know, attend all the classes and et cetera, for your degree. But what's your real passion would be the kind of question that I'd ask. And somebody would say, well, I'm really passionate about Kierkegaard. Okay, well, why don't we form an informal group and read him and study him and kick the football around or go to a pub and drink a few beers and eat some chicken wings you know, let's talk about something more radical. So I've always believed in both the validity of institutions and the validity of formal programs and the possibility of doing something that is more spontaneous and informal, just as much as we hear from persons such as Henry Nouwen, who would say, my interruptions were my most meaningful ministry. You know, that kind of an idea. Well, that's something that I've strongly believed, because what has happened is that formal institutions can play a role, but what people do informally, like friendship or family hospitality or having just a small group where you study a book and discuss it or whatever, or even being involved as a small group of friends in terms of some activist project, that's equally valid. So I've always believed in both and. And then sometimes, of course, what happens is you emphasize the one more than the other, and so people then conceive you as being radical, whereas I don't think that I'm radical in the sense that I'm anti-institutional. I'm radical in the sense that I believe that institutions and formal structures don't have all the answers.
Charles Ringman lives in Brisbane, but he spent years overseas, in Canada at Regent College and also at the Asian Theological Seminary in Manila, the Philippines, where he was professor of theology and mission. He's a serious Christian, which doesn't mean he's not open to other religions, nor to the varied traditions within Christianity, including the contemplative practice and intentional community of monasticism. This is The Spirit of Things, and we're on a journey of faith that's brought Charles Ringma a long way from the Dutch Reformed Church he was born into. What church do you belong to now?
I attend an Anglican church just down the road here, almost within walking distance, St. Clement's on the Hill. But I also do informal stuff, so Northumbria Community. Next week we have a theology group that meets once a month in our house. I'm involved in a range of informal activities, mainly with friends, where we do all sorts of things. So it's the both and. That's really the thing that I'm committed to.
Well, one of the things that you have been committed to for some time has been writing your latest book, Hearing the Ancient Wisdom, which is a large book of reflections that is very inspiring, very thoughtful, wide-ranging. And I wanted to ask you what prompted your writing this book, which almost seems like a kind of summation of your wisdom.
Well, I've always been attracted not only to what is, but also to what should be present. So the way I tend to think is, okay, so what's immediate? But what's distant and maybe should become more immediate. And as a result, one of the things that has particularly struck me, and this has come out of teaching in various institutions, is how many students who are now going to colleges and seminaries in terms of getting some sort of Christian formation come from single standing churches. They're not part of a wider tradition. They're simply a tradition in and of themselves. And that greatly concerns me. So it's almost what I then invent in terms of my own self-actualization as an individual or as a small group, that then becomes the end-all and be-all of a particular religious tradition. So that has completely freaked me out. And then recognizing that whether one is part of the evangelical tradition, we don't go back to earlier sources. Whether one is part of the Reformation tradition, we tend not to go back to Calvin or Luther or Zwingli and so forth and so on. And of course, a lot of us neglect the long tradition of the early church fathers, the whole monastic tradition and the medieval mystics. So that's 1,400 years of a very rich heritage that contemporary Christians tend to know very little about.
So this is really, what you're describing is a denominationalism that's become extreme almost.
Yes, I am very concerned about tribalism. I'm very concerned about thinking in little boxes. And I believe that what needs to happen is we constantly need to be pulled out of our comfort zones into a wider and richer tradition. That's why I also believe we need to be open to other religious traditions as well. So what I have sought to do in Hear the Ancient Wisdom is for contemporary readers to make them aware of how rich that tradition is and how much that particular tradition can challenge us today.
Well, let me take a few thoughts from that book. One of them is that living in faith is not to stop asking hard questions. And I think that's on page 119.
Yes, because faith by its very nature is a journey. It's a development. It's an unfolding. And the thing that I think is the weakness of contemporary religiosity is that because the secular world seems to be so threatening, that as a consequence we then tend to batten down the hatches and tend to want to live in a micro world of self-imposed security. Which I think is living a certain form of death. The way to live life is to have your doors and windows open and to continue to seek and to search and to knock.
Yes, I think you say that somewhere else in the book. Coming to faith is a homecoming, but it is also a journey that never ends.
Exactly. Yes, and I think one of the basic educational concepts that I've worked with for a long time is people who are deeply rooted are people who can also fly. So basically, what I mean by that is that if you are rooted in a particular faith, that can then give you enough inner groundedness. And at the same time, enough security to allow you then to push the boundaries and to explore and to be open and to be experimental and to be innovative. So that's when you're flying, right?
Let me ask you about something else. Now, you have mentioned your own attraction to monasticism. But monasticism has also produced some unhelpful attitudes, particularly dualistic thinking and a kind of us and them, or more importantly, a belief that asceticism, excessive asceticism, the denial of the body is the only way to finally unite with God. And you've talked about that dualistic thinking.
Yes. It's true that that within the monastic tradition there have been unhealthy emphases. But on the other hand, I think that we very seriously misread the monastic tradition if we think that monks were only navel gazers and we're only concerned about the spiritual side of life. We think, for example, of the monastic tradition. They prayed, they also worked, and they thought a lot about how to integrate the relationship between work and prayer. There were many communities that set up orphanages and hospitals and so on. And of course, we need to realize that it was the monastic communities that actually laid the basis for modern Europe in terms of the townships that later developed around that. So I think that one of the challenges for us is to reread the monastic tradition, not in terms of some of its aberrations, in terms of dualistic thinking, but more in terms of its major themes. And I think the major themes that I have gleaned from the monastic tradition is that, first of all, to be in relationship is important. Whether you do that formally as a monastic community or whether you do that informally as friendship is equally okay as far as I'm concerned. The other important thing that we learn from the monastic tradition is the value of contemplation, meditation, slowing down, being still. The third thing that we learn from the monastic tradition is how we need to bring our prayer life into our activism, into our daily work. So a kind of an integrated perspective. And I think the other really important issue that we can glean from the monastic tradition is how to develop sustainable rhythms of life. So in terms of contemporary society, where we are 24/7, in terms of communication, where we are incredibly busy, over-preoccupied, as a consequence, not very reflective, I think one of the things that we can learn from the monastic tradition is how to develop more sustainable rhythms in our daily life.
Well, what you've described is a sort of life that seems to be antithetical to the modern West. Mm-hmm. Does this mean that the only way we can live out this whole spiritual life of wholeness is actually to opt out?
I certainly don't believe that, first of all, that the monks, in terms of their broad tradition, that they opted out. I think they were involved in agriculture, care for people, the arts, and so forth and so on. So they didn't opt out, and I believe that we must not opt out either. I believe that we have a task in our world. But what I do believe is that we need to ask the question, who is setting the agenda for our lives and who is orchestrating for us what a good life looks like? And I think that we need to be a little more critical of the kind of contemporary thinking with regard to how we do our work and how we live well. And I think the missing component that is in our present daily life, with all the pressures of maybe two jobs and further training in terms of really busy lifestyle, is that we need to become more reflective and more recollected persons. We need to find ways in terms of how to gather ourselves up into ourselves in a more integrated kind of way. And therefore, I think we need to take on board various forms of meditative practices which allow us to create a kind of an inner zone of stillness within our own lives, from which and out of which we can then live in relation to our busy jobs, busy family, whatever the case may be.
Charles Ringmer, does this actually entail then a redefinition of what it is to be an activist Christian? That is to say, is it going to redefine church out of existence as we now know it?
Well, I certainly think that we need to make some fundamental changes. So, for example, my experience of church is that it's a lot of words, it's a lot of music, it's a lot of activity. I can't find a quiet zone within the kind of church that I attend. So to some extent, I think that what's happened is that the kind of the dominant, modern, busy way, activist way of being is something also that that the church has taken on board. In fact, one of the great missional thinkers, Leslie Newbegin, stated that that the modern church is the most culturally captive church in history. So what he then is inviting us to do is to do some radical kind of rethinking in terms of the way we seek to live our lives, the way in which we do church, the way maybe in which we do family and so forth and so on. And in writing the book, Hear the Ancient Wisdom, I've been probing some of that kind of older wisdom to see if that can be a source of inspiration for us to begin to do some radical rethinking.
Well, having read your book, I think it probably will be around for a long time, inspiring people to do just that. Charles Ringmer, it's been such a delight speaking to you here in your home, even with all those birds and planes yes. out there
going on. It is a real world out there.
Indeed. Well, once again, thank you so much. And may your new form of Christian life grow and prosper.
Thank you, Rachel.
Charles Ringmer is the author of Hear the Ancient Wisdom, which is a wonderful day-by-day collection of readings and commentary, something to keep you company for a whole year. Find out more details of the book on the Spirit of Things website. Charles Ringmer is on the journey of faith. Others who are changing and transforming the way they relate to the church are called Progressive Christians, and they're meeting in Canberra this week. We'll be hearing from one of their leading lights in the near future, Marcus Borg. In the meantime, you can download the audio of this program by finding us on the RN homepage. The Spirit of Things is produced by me and Jeff Wood, with sound engineering this week by Charlie McEwen. Next week, it's God in the boardroom. Can designing organizational life take a cue from the book of Genesis? Tony Goldsby-Smith thinks it can.
Our corporate world, I prefer to say our organizational world, because I think it's a public sector as well, is really built on very mechanistic assumptions of the industrial organization. Lots of people don't like that, whether they're Christians or not. They think it's not flexible enough, not innovative enough, and not human enough. It's definitely in some ways, at its worst, a hostile environment to the human spirit. And a lot of the better organisations around the world are trying to change that and recraft organisations into something that's more conducive to the human spirit.
That's The Spirituality of Design with me, Rachel Kahn, on The Spirit of Things, right here on RN.